shut down your algorithms and get back to school. It's another Flat Chat with me, Stuart Codling, and special guests. The September issue of GP Racing hits the newsstands today, and it's certainly feeling very autumnal outside here in Surrey. But what's it like in Oxfordshire? Well, joining us to answer that question and many others is Mark Gallagher from home. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Stuart. Well, yeah, it's kind of February here, I think, today. It's pouring with rain. Can't see beyond the end of the garden fence. So, yeah, very glad to be in my warm office talking to you.
You'll need to whiz your boat up from wherever it's docked now up the M40 and park it outside your house. Wait for the rising water level.
I don't think that would be difficult.
Also joining us with his eyelids propped up with matchsticks today, it's GP Racing editor Ben Anderson. Hello, Ben. Congratulations. A new addition to the family arrived a couple of weeks ago. Freshly back from paternity leave is Ben, where he's been leaving us the run of the virtual office, and we've managed to permit a grotesque typographical error to go to press in his absence, which you'll enjoy when you pick up the magazine on the newsstands. Perhaps if you're a subscriber, you've already spotted it and are rolling up a copy to whack an effigy of us that you've constructed. Anyway, hello, Ben.
Yes, spot the deliberate mistake. I mean, to be honest, I'd forgotten even that the magazine was coming out. I've been so knee-deep in nappies and lack of sleep. I don't know what day it is. So Mark says it's February. Which means my daughter must be about 6 months old now, somehow.
You wish.
In a weird... Well, yes, I do. I wish. So, obviously very happy that everything went smoothly. And, we had a baby girl, born healthy and happy. And now we're coping with going back in time and dealing with her 1.5-year-old brother at the same time.
When our daughter arrived, my son, who was 3, asked us after a couple of weeks. He said, well, you know, she's been great fun, but could we leave her out with the bins? Which he's never been allowed to forget, because he certainly wouldn't remember it. But we remind him every year, usually on her birthday, that he wanted her to be taken away by the dustman.
We'll see what happens in the Anderson household then. Anyway, so Ben, if you recall, this month's issue of GP Racing out today, already on subscribers' doormats. If it isn't, then ping us an email via the address on the inside cover of the copy you don't have. We've got Fernando Alonso on the cover.
Yes.
who would have thought we'd have Fernando Alonso on the cover of GP Racing again? But yes, the year that's given us lockdown, algorithm generated exam results, and Apple Music having the temerity, the gall, the sheer brass neck to recommend a David Gray song to me, has delivered another sucker punch. And we were only half joking in the last podcast when we said we were going to set Fernando Alonso's biggest fanboy on the case. Because, yes, in the new issue, the BBC's own Andrew Benson, Fernando's biggest fanboy, has weighed up Fernando's F1 comeback with Renault. Will third time be the charm? Our feature asks if this is a marriage remade in heaven.
Get it?
Well, yeah. You see what we did there? And our graphic designer, as ever, despite the massive shortage of pictures, has worked magic again. I dare say that when we next actually see him in person, he'll be full of grey hairs. But moving on, Mark, are you aligned with Mr. Benson on this one, that ultimately it's a great thing?
Well, I have to say, reading the article, reading the feature, I think Andrew's done a really good job of balancing the pros and cons of Alonso's return. He's
as you'd expect from a BBC journalist.
As you'd expect from a BBC. Absolutely. But he really does kind of go into the detail of the fact that they talk to, they being Renault, they talk to Fernando about his age, the age that he will be when he gets back into Formula One, and the age he will be by the end of his contract. Really interesting to see Alain Prost quoted as talking about the fact that Fernando's sometimes divisive approach to inter-team politics, maybe even creating the politics in a team, was something that bothered him, and that Fernando has promised to put that behind him. But I think overall my takeaway from it is that, and it's really, I suppose, Andrew's conclusion to the story, I think Renault and Alonso are going into this with both eyes open, and they realise that he's not going to jump in that car next year and go out and start winning races. It's a two-year project. And I think the kind of recent happening that makes me hope that the Alonso return really will be very successful is what we saw from Nico Hülkenberg when he returned to the cockpit at Racing Point at Silverstone. There's nothing like being away from the sport for a while to give a driver that fire in his belly, even if they didn't realise the fire had somehow diminished slightly over time. And again, Cyril Abiteboul in the feature talks about the sometimes toxic environment of Formula One. And so having a break from that might have re-energised Fernando's batteries. And it's great, I think, for Formula One that he's coming back. It's going to be a fascinating story to see develop, however long it lasts.
Well, you've changed your tune, Mark, because when he was featured on the cover of the February issue, you said, "Oh, he'll never come back. There's no need. It's done. It's dusted." Well, so I'm getting my popcorn emoji out now, everyone, because I was expecting to go toe-to-toe with you on this, and you seem to have come around to the way of thinking that, well, basically...
I'm very disappointed in you, Ben, that you remembered me saying that back in February. I mean... We live in a media landscape where the President of the United States can change policies in a tweet, and I can't change my mind over 6 months. Exactly. Fundamentally, I don't think it's the right thing for drivers to come back into Formula One at the age of 39, 40. And I do think that, you know, one thing I would disagree with in the feature is when you look at Nigel Mansell's performance, you know, winning the Australian Grand Prix in 1994 at the age of 41, or, you know, Alain Prost coming back into Formula One after a sabbatical. The world of Formula One has completely changed. The technology has really changed. The speed of the cars, the precision of the cars. That's not to say cars weren't precise back then, but what I mean by that is, you know, if you listen to, Andrew Green, the technical director of Racing Point, has given a very good podcast to Formula One this year, and he, you know, he's probably better equipped than most to talk about how the technology has changed, because he's been at Jordan at that team since day one, and he said it's just an entirely different business today from what it was, you know, back in the 90s. So when people talk about the 90s, actually Formula One technically and dynamically from a race car point of view was a completely different environment. It was an analog environment, whereas today we live in a digital environment. And I think it's a big ask for Fernando to come back, and he might get the shock of his life when he comes back, as Michael Schumacher kind of did, albeit for slightly different reasons. But the reality is that it's a big ask, but I'm prepared to back it. Andrew's points, which he articulates very well. So I'm saying, well done, Andrew. It's a very interesting feature, and let's bring it on and see how Fernando gets on.
Yeah, I think in Alonso's favour is the fact that, you know, the tyres are not really changing an awful lot from the ones that he last raced on. I mean, you know, Pirelli have carried 2019 tyres into 2020. They're looking to do similar for 21, aren't they, in conjunction with a cut in downforce to help them out. Alonso did some driving in 19 for McLaren, so he's got some continuity there. On the other hand, this is the reason that Lewis Hamilton has decided not to take a sabbatical in the past, even though he's thought about it, is this idea that the championship moves on relentlessly and leaves you behind very quickly. So 2 years out could mean that Alonso comes back, you know, fresh, full of vigour. It's maybe slightly naive of Renault to think he'd be a different person, but he may be a more committed and more motivated driver than he was when he left. But on the flip side, have the cars moved on to an extent that just leave him a little bit wrong-footed? In saying that, of course, with 2021 being this kind of holding pattern year, he's got a year to shake off the rust, hasn't he, in a car that then won't carry forward to 2022 when there's a massive reset for everybody. So that could work in his favour, provided he hasn't reached a kind of physical decline by the time he's heading into his 41st year.
I don't know about physical decline heading into your 41st year.
What do you reckon, Connors?
Some people are fitter than ever at that age.
That's what Alonso claims, isn't it? He said that he did a fitness test. I mean, God knows why, because he's not racing this year in F1, but he claims he did a fitness test just before he announced his Renault reunion and said that he was fitter than ever. Obviously, he's been competing as well, so it's not like he's just been sat on the sofa putting on the lockdown 10 or whatever you might call it. So you know, maybe it's true.
Eating Maltesers or whatever. Yeah, I suppose my only reservation about it was brought home to me this week when on the social media, one-time editor of... The social media.
Do you mean a specific form of social media, Connors, or just
something
across the board?
Something that the dossers in broadcasting would call Twitter. The former editor of F1 Racing, as GP Racing was, Matt Bishop, on one of his On This Day tweeted the cover of an issue of F1 Racing that came out this time in 2003 or thereabouts. I think it was around this time in 2003 or thereabouts, which featured very young Fernando and a very young Kimi Raikkonen on the cover. Fernando had just won his first Grand Prix.
Taken
his maiden Grand Prix win.
Indeed,
we should
yes.
phrase it properly, in case sub-editors are listening. And the cover line was, "This is the future of Formula One." And you think, well, yeah, actually, brilliantly right. And yet, here we are, 17 years later, and they haven't bogged off and left the way clear for new people to come in.
Andrew kind of makes this point in the feature as well. What was the better alternative? I mean, if you look through the list of people who were out of contract, because so many contracts were done before the season started and before this move was made, I mean, Lewis Hamilton is the obvious top candidate, but of course he's never going to leave Mercedes unless he wants to stop, really, because there isn't a better seat than the one he's in now. They talked to Valtteri Bottas, but I feel like if you go for Bottas, obviously he wanted to stay at Mercedes and he's only going to look elsewhere if they say, you know, we don't want to renew another one-year deal. You don't really feel like you're getting an upgrade compared to Daniel Ricciardo, I don't think, with Bottas. Arguably a similar level. Maybe Ricciardo's done slightly better in winning in inferior cars, but Bottas brings that top team, championship-winning team experience. Hülkenberg is obviously on the market, but they binned him so that they could sign Ocon. So where else? The only other candidate is Vettel. Is Vettel, having raced continuously, a better bet than... and Alonso, who's been out for a couple of years? I mean...
Well, it's interesting because when I was reading that, I thought I would assign Vettel. And I would assign Vettel on the basis that... I mean, I firmly believe the guy deserves to stay on Formula One. I think he's had a very difficult time at Ferrari for all kinds of reasons. Probably some issues on his side, some issues on the team. I think like a lot of things in life, the moment you start trying too hard, the mistakes can keep coming. And that would have been my kind of gut feeling would be, you know, he's, what, seven years younger than Fernando, and he's got, to my mind, a good three-year contract left in him, which would have been good to have. But my reservation there is whether Renault can have the kind of culture needed to get the arms put round a driver like Vettel and build the team around him in the way that I still hope Aston Martin do for next year with bringing him into Racing Point. That's going to be an interesting decision when it's all decided upon. So I'm a big fan of Vettel staying in Formula One, and I think Renault would have benefited from having a driver come straight from Ferrari, because he might get in their car and say, oh, it's actually faster than the Ferrari. So it's in relative terms, it might have been a step up. But it's anyway, it is what it is. And I think the Alonso opportunity Cyril Abiteboul talks about the fact that there was even an emotional quotient in the decision, you know, kind of bringing everything back together again. I'm not sure that has much of a place to play in Formula One business decisions these days, the kind of emotional factor. When I was at running Cosworth, we lost our engine deal to Renault, and I remember Adam Parr at Williams telling me about how, you know, Williams, Renault were going to go back to their heyday. For the relaunch, they had all...
When's that going to happen?
There's a good reason Adam Parr's nickname was Below.
And I hadn't heard that one. That's quite good, actually. So they had Damon Hill and Jacques Villeneuve, and I think even DC at the relaunch of Williams, Renault. And I remember thinking, well, yeah, but you're not going back to the days of Williams, Renault, are you? Because, you know, fundamentally, the team doesn't have as
anything like the car that it had back then, or indeed the technical capability that it had back then. And so it proved. And so I think decisions made on let's go back to what we had before, because those were such great times and we'll rediscover it. Times have moved on, you know, history doesn't tend to repeat itself in quite that way. So
moving back to your position in February.
No, I'm not moving.
Alonso was the wrong move, and they should have signed
Vettel.
This
vehicle is reversing.
And it was a knee-jerk signing of Alonso based on the panic of losing Ricciardo.
Can you hear the beep beep sound as I reverse slowly away from my desk
towards the boat in the garden?
Towards the boat in the garden. No, I'm going to stick to what I said earlier, which is that, you know, I think Andrew's given a good balanced kind of feature about the reasons why that this has happened, and I'm prepared to go with it and see how it pans out. As I say, if it had been me, I would have signed Sebastian Vettel, but fortunately for the people at Enstone, I'm not running their Formula One team, so I think it's all good stuff, really.
Well, two things in Alonso's favour are, I mean, past team principals that have worked with him say, you know, he's a great reference, engineering reference to have in the car. You know within a lap or two laps where you are precisely with the package. And I think Renault probably needs that. Ricciardo gave them the reference for the team in terms of where they were structurally compared to, say, Red Bull. But Alonso probably gives them arguably that little bit of extra edge in terms of where is this car relative to the rest of the competition. That's no disservice to Ricciardo. And of course, Alonso is one of those drivers who has a history of annihilating his teammates. That word's in the news again with Jenson Button saying, you know, Verstappen is doing that to his teammates on a level we haven't really seen since Senna or Schumacher. But Alonso's got a track record of doing that, you know, to the likes of Kimi, to Massa, to Van Dorn. And Vettel, the jury's out there, isn't it? Of course, he had a great start to his career, but he's had two recent teammates who've well and truly got the better of him in his own team, in Ricciardo, who's obviously, you know, leaving Renault now, and in this case, Charles Leclerc. So I'm not sure if you sign Vettel, especially a Vettel whose confidence is maybe a bit low and he needs some time to rebuild. He's not going to provide you perhaps exactly with what you need straight away in the way that Alonso, providing these 2 years haven't blunted him, is going to do.
There's a really excellent an excellent description of Alonso's ability to highlight any issues with the car when he's driving it because of his consistency. And I think it's a quote from Andrea Stella, the performance engineer at McLaren, talking about how so many drivers, when they're faced with an imbalance in the car, whatever that may be, aerodynamic or mechanical or both, they start to drive around that problem, and they adapt their driving style to the point where the engineers don't know where they stand corner to corner. They're not getting a consistent approach. Where he said with Alonso, you can look at the data, and he has helped the team to understand where it is that the car is inconsistent, and that helps you to move it forward. And that's I think that's a kind of beautiful insight into top drivers that makes you realize why we have top drivers in Formula One, and that we're going to probably talk about algorithms deciding who's a top driver, but
no oxygen of publicity to that.
Yeah. No, okay, but the
kill that can get in the sea. That
it
list.
Can get in the in definitely in the sea, in the bin, set fire to it.
That was an outburst, wasn't it?
Yes.
The reality is that when you talk to top engineers about top drivers, they give you that kind that feedback about. In this, you know, in this data-driven, data-obsessed environment that Formula One is, that the human input can make such a fundamental difference, and that the top drivers can really give those marginal gains, take it to another level, and that's what I think what keeps all of us excited about the sport. Because when you see the top drivers and the top cars going out there and winning, you actually know these people are pretty special at what they do.
Of course, if algorithms were to be allowed to determine which driver got the seat, it would, of course, be Jarno Trulli who would be occupying that seat right now.
I think it would have been Heikki Kovalainen, because he was ahead of Jarno in that particular pecking order, which we won't talk about any further.
Yes, that thing that appeared in my inbox, which I realised was either the stupidest thing I was ever going to read or a really fatuous attempt to make me and lots of people on the internet angry. So without further ado,
well,
I deleted it.
As Mark Hughes wrote, I think, on Twitter, surely Ross Brawn and Rob Smedley have better things to do with their time than this.
Can I just add that the day it came out, I had a conference call with Mika Häkkinen, and I broke the news to him that he hadn't made the top 20.
Well, he was a togger, wasn't he? We can reveal it now. He was a togger, lucky two-time world champion, according to the algorithm, waste of space.
And as we're heading into the 20th anniversary of his famous Spa win against Michael Schumacher, I have to say Mika was fairly nonplussed. He said he would much prefer to race Michael than an algorithm any day. So
maybe you could play some gentle David Gray music or something else chosen by Apple Music's equally useless algorithm to soundtrack that particular tale of woe.
But this is a good indication of, as you know, Mark was alluding to, the importance of the human element. You know, Formula One's become this hugely data-driven thing, and everyone's become a slave to it to a lot, you know, lesser or greater extent. And I remember doing an interview with Andrea Stella for a special feature on Alonso in Autosport a few years ago, and he made a similar point to the one that he made in Andrew's feature, that the most important thing about Alonso from the engineer's perspective is that he was able, unlike any other driver he'd worked with or seen, to delineate his own performance from the car, when of course, you know, the two are inexorably linked all the time. But Alonso is able to tell you at what point he's the limitation and at what point the car is, much more precisely than most other drivers, and that really helps the team in terms of driving their car forward. Of course, the problem you might get into there, and perhaps we've seen this in Alonso's career, is that because his reference is so good, the engineering operation gravitates towards that feedback, and it can leave the other driver floundering a bit and unable to drive the car that is so precisely modelled towards what Alonso is doing.
In a separate but related feature to this, we've had a look at the drivers who are kind of the being displaced. We speak to Carlos Sainz, who's the first mover that caused the displacement that set the dominoes in motion, as it were.
He was the displacer.
He was the displacer. We look at the displaced, and we've looked at Fernando Alonso's arrival at Renault to replace Daniel Ricciardo, who will be replacing Carlos Sainz at McLaren, who will be replacing Sebastian Vettel at Ferrari. So,
this is confusing, isn't it? I hope we haven't displaced the listeners' brains.
Yeah,
with this,
previously on Flat Chat, our contention is that it's quite unusual. It's not unprecedented, but it's quite unusual for there to be this many drivers beginning a season with their next move either settled or not knowing where they're going. So beginning the season knowing that they will
on
not
notice,
be driving for this team. So they're serving out their notice. It's quite unusual.
However,
Fernando
Mark
himself,
Gallagher will beg to differ, won't he?
I think he will. I think he's got a bucket full of ice to pour all over this whole proposition, haven't you, Mark?
What, in terms of drivers, what it's like to have a driver leaving your team?
Well, what it's like to have a driver sort of on permanent, sort of serving their notice throughout the season. Obviously, you know, when you're at Jordan, you sort of had, it was like the countdown math section round of drivers, wasn't it? I'll have one from the top, one from the middle and one from the bottom, please, Carol.
Well, it's something I hadn't really thought about until I read this excellent feature, and
authored by our very own Stuart Codling.
Oh yeah. Yes, so I did.
Yeah, you did. And I went back. I thought this is kind of a quaint notion of, you know, some teams obviously have stability, and then they have a year, and then there's this bizarre notion that there might be a year when there's a driver leaving. And I wondered why I was thinking about that. And then I went back and checked that in 15 years of Jordan Grand Prix, we never had the same two drivers for two full consecutive seasons.
Even when we
tried to do it, which was in 94, 95, when we had Rubens and Eddie Irvine together, Eddie managed to get himself banned in 94. and he missed three races. So we drafted in Inigiri Suzuki and Andrea De Cesare. So, Rubens had a four-year contract. So basically in Jordan Formula One terms, Rubens Barrichello was the absolute exception. And it reminds me that consecutive car launches, we would have to rewrite the kind of press release about the driver lineup, because
scrub that one. That's issue three. We're on to five
Jordan
now.
Grand Prix sponsored by Tipex.
I mean, it was so great when, you know, PCs came along with software where you could just do a search and replace on the driver's on the driver's name, because Yeah, I remember this so well. 1997, Eddie stood up and said, you know, I've always believed in youth. Youth is the future. So we have signed Ralf Schumacher and Giancarlo Fisichella. Fast forward 12 months. Youth really doesn't work. So we have decided to go for youth and experience. And Damon Hill is joining our team for this year alongside Ralf Schumacher. And then the following year, we got rid of the youth bit. And Eddie stood up and said, well, you know, these young people are just liabilities. So we've decided to sign two really experienced drivers. So we've got Damon Hill for a second season with Heinz Harald Frentzen. And so it continued. And it was just something I hadn't really ever thought about too much. And there were lots of reasons why I think a small independent team was constantly thrashing around looking for drivers with money and sponsors and all the rest of it. But I have a sneaking suspicion that there's something to do with the culture as well there, which meant that there was never any stability. And ultimately, that's got to have been a bad thing.
Speaking of PCs, I also noticed recently that the 29th anniversary has passed of CS Gasso. I mean, Bertrand Gachot's little brush with the law on Hyde Park Corner, also necessitating Jordan looking for a new driver.
And Eddie Jordan being interviewed on TV saying we believe in investing in youths, and Michael Schumacher was available, so
free
we've got him
plastic
in the car.
Bertrand.
Well, actually, $150,000 was available. More to the point, which is the
did it come in a suitcase? That's what I want to know. Did it come in a suitcase?
Which was, I mean, there's lots of data points talking about data. Well, the biggest data point for us was how much money have you got to bring, and that's going to help you into the drive. But I actually was in the office that day at Silverstone in the original unit where, which used to be Eddie Jordan Racing's Formula 3000 unit at Silverstone. And we knew that Bertrand had a court appearance for what we thought was a minor traffic offence. We really didn't know any details. And I remember the phone ringing and...
Well, you thought he'd maybe parked in the wrong place or...
Yeah, yeah. My memory tells me it was Ian Phillips who took the call. And then came into the office. Eddie and I were sitting having a coffee, and he came in and said, oh, Bertrand's just been jailed. And there was just stunned silence as we took this on board. We couldn't, you know, what the heck has happened? And sure enough, so it proved. And I will never quite forget that, because we had to issue a press statement. I've never had to write a press release saying our Formula One driver, Bertrand Gachot, has just been taken to Brixton. And
you're nicked, Sam.
Yeah, and we will now be looking for a replacement driver for the Belgian Grand Prix. And then various other things, and such as having to call our sponsors at Fujifilm, Japanese company, very proud, very, very conservative company, and explaining to them that... one of the drivers being used in the current billboard campaign in Tokyo was
Her Majesty's
doing time.
Exactly. And so it went on and went on. But a very memorable week, including going to see Michael drive a Formula One car for the very first time at Silverstone South Circuit. So that was all a very interesting stuff. Can I share one final thing that Bertrand told me about his time in Brixton? So he told me that the currency, the ultimate currency in jail, was cigarettes. I have a feeling you got paid for whatever chores you did, like if you did a bit of gardening or whatever. I think you didn't get paid in cash, or if you did get paid in cash, actually cigarettes were more valuable. So, but the problem was that Bertrand, despite the fact that he'd been a long-time Marlboro driver, didn't smoke. So he ended up with lots of cigarettes, didn't know what to do with them. So he discovered you could trade these, and he used to trade his cigarettes each week for one Mars bar. And he would then slice the Mars bar into seven pieces, and he would have one piece a day, and that was his luxury item.
Well, that's discipline, isn't it, to make sure
and
you
that's
only
discipline.
Have the one piece
that's
a day.
That's discipline. I always remember him telling me
where was
that
discipline before he went to prison?
Yeah. Yeah, well, anyway, but there we go. So, Bertrand, if you're listening, I have a lot of sympathy for what you went through at that pretty dreadful time, and it was extraordinary.
Been very successful in business ever since, so
it has
served him well.
And by the way, I do firmly believe that he went to prison because the judge wanted to make an example of him. Apparently, Bertrand turned up in court very smartly dressed, but unfortunately with his luggage.
Oh,
because he was planning to go to, I think he was going to Italy or somewhere for a business meeting, and his view was that this smug international Formula One driver standing in front of him wasn't going to be going anywhere soon. And the reason he had the CS gas in his car was because it was legal for, particularly for women, to carry pepper spray in their car in France and Belgium in case they get attacked, whatever. So it was his girlfriend's pepper spray, but it was unfortunately Bertrand's decision to use that and then to hide it in the toilet cistern of a nearby office, which really compromised his case in court.
I wonder if Sebastian Vettel would like to use a can of CS spray on Mattia Binotto after what's been happening this year. Because, I mean, that's probably the one example of the three where things aren't going quite as smoothly as you might hope. Obviously, science has done, as Cod has mentioned in his feature, has done things in a very upfront way. You know, he went to McLaren senior management first, said, you know, I've got an approach from Ferrari, I'd like to talk to them. You know, so they gave him their blessing, and you know, he's able to do this season, having, you know, not really had any fallings out with McLaren, not been there long enough to do that either, but also having behaved, I guess, with a certain degree of honesty that they've appreciated, and so he can kind of see out this season, you know, with no real trouble. I think with Ricciardo, I don't think it's clear that Renault didn't like the way he dropped the bombshell that he was off to take Sainz's seat, but, you know, once that's out the way, Renault are happy with their alternative solution. They've got Alonso in the car. You could argue that's an upgrade maybe for them from where they are now. And Ricciardo's still the reference in the car, isn't he, for this season. So it makes sense that they just put that behind them and get on with the job because they're in a tight fight with the other midfield teams. But with the Ferrari situation, it feels like that breakdown has been longer in the making, that perhaps behind the scenes, Vettel and the Ferrari management haven't been getting on for a while, as, you know, they failed to win championship after championship and things haven't come together. And then, of course, the way that Ferrari announces Vettel's departure, that they, you know, agreed their long-term goals weren't in alignment, and then Vettel comes out and says, well, I was never offered a contract, and he starts speaking quite openly in the media once the season begins that things haven't played out the way Ferrari made out. It just doesn't show that they have any kind of real relationship left, I think. And then he's obviously struggled at the start of the season. It feels like there's no going back from that. That's probably the one example where you feel like the driver being on notice is not helpful for either party.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think I may have mentioned this in a previous podcast, but David Coulthard has the view that Sebastian Vettel really lacks for having a proper manager. And yeah. And
they smooth the back waters, don't they?
They're able to talk
to people and just they, you know, can talk sure to things back. A bit happier behind the scenes, and he doesn't have
He doesn't have that. I had a young driver call me last week, 18, 19 years of age, wants to get to Formula One, and I said, do you have a manager? And he said, no. And he said, you know, they're too expensive, they just want to claw, you know, 15% out of your income. And
And I said, kiss 10% of arses.
And I said to him, but
why can't I play the lead?
15 now, the rate's gone up.
And, you know, the reality is that for a young driver's earning nothing, you know, paying 15% of nothing is nothing. So, you know, do you want 15, you know, surely earning 85% of something is going to be a pretty good outcome. But exactly to your point, Ben, the thing that happens when you have a manager is that while the driver's busy driving their car, attending briefings, going to sponsor meetings, the manager can be finding out what's actually happening, not only in his team, but in all the other teams, having conversations. And a manager may well have read the tea leaves a little bit earlier than Sebastian and said to him, you know, I have a feeling Leclerc's going to get a long-term contract here, and we may not, you know, we may not be in a strong position, so we need to put feelers out today. And the thing
is exactly what Sainz's management did when he was in this situation of Renault wanted him, but they couldn't afford to pay the release clause from Red Bull, and it was looking like Red Bull weren't going to take him back because they wanted to promote Gasly. He was essentially going to be frozen out, but he'd already, like you said, read the tea leaves. The management did a massive scenario planning situation with the whiteboard coming into 2018 and said, well, this could happen, Ocon could take our seat, or this could happen, Hülkenberg could go here. And they actually then made a point of sounding out McLaren because they identified that Van Dorn was vulnerable, not performing very well against Alonso, and there might be a chance to squeak in there if McLaren decided to get rid of Vann, and of course in the end Alonso decided to step down, so it looked like there was more room than they bargained on. But they were already doing exactly what you described there, reading the tea leaves and making sure you have somewhere to land on your feet if things don't go in your favour.
I think it's a kind of a bizarre notion for listeners to maybe think about, which is that if you work in a Formula One team, be it as a driver or anything else, you live in a bubble. You live a parallel existence that, you know, that you don't meet other teams. You don't spend, you don't really come out of, you know, a meeting in your team and nip next door to have a cup of coffee. It doesn't really happen like that. You're so busy all the time, especially if, you know, at the race weekends, you're there for a purpose. And as a result, you can actually, over a period of years, begin to realize you don't know anyone else in the paddock. You only know your team. You just work in that team environment. And for a driver, I think the other benefit of having a manager is that, and I've seen this happen myself during my career, is the management community. So the number of managers who are active in Formula One are very small. We're talking about probably a dozen people. And they talk to each other, and they have, many of them have had to do deals together where a driver's gone from one to another or moved from one team to another. And there's lots of relationships there. And it's actually not beyond the realms of possibility for a manager to come and say to you, by the way, my driver's leaving that team. Bit of a tip off, you know, my driver's leaving that team. You know, how valuable would it have been for Sebastian Vettel to have been in a discussion with Renault before the end of last year, saying, you know, I think your man Ricciardo's off, or, you know,
The way Alonso did, you know, says they had conversations in Abu Dhabi 2019, yeah, where Alonso, yeah, obviously was there doing a few, he did a few TV appearances, didn't he? But
yeah,
he was already, you know, putting the feelers out.
It's so important. And there's a, dare I plug another podcast again, but again, the Julian Jacoby podcast with Formula One, on the Formula One official podcast, Julian Jacoby being the former manager famously of both Alain Prost and Ayrton Senna at the same time, and currently the manager of Sergio Perez. So I suspect he's had a rather busy year this year. you know, but it's really interesting to hear Julian talk about the way in which it all works and how important it is to have a manager. And a good manager, a good quality manager who not only has your trust and respect, but the trust and respect of the people that they deal with. And I think in Sebastian's case, having a good lawyer, apparently he has a very good lawyer working for him. A lawyer is great, but the problem is lawyers kind of raise a slight red flag when people know that your first and foremost purpose in life is legal. People watch what they say and how they say it, and that could be something of a drawback. And there is a little bit of a misconception that somehow, you know, a manager is either a sponsor finder or a manager has to be a lawyer. Actually, a manager has to be many, many things in order to effectively manage a driver's career. But most of all, they have to be a people person so that they can come to you and tell you some home truths sooner than later and say, actually, this isn't going to work out. We need to find a new avenue to pursue. And I think that's been something that Fernando has been missing. And I also wonder if in time it might become something that Lewis Hamilton misses, because he essentially now has his own management team that he's put together. And, you know, I don't think Lewis needs to worry. I think it's pretty clear that his career path is going to be with Mercedes right until he decides to hang up his helmet. But it's when you get to those pinch points in your career that having a manager who will maybe tell you some things that are uncomfortable to hear, that becomes a really important, valuable piece of information.
And also, a lawyer is a bit too late in the process as well, isn't it? You know, it's all very well once if you're trying to decide on specific terms in the contracts or clauses or amounts for this, that and the other, but we're talking about a paddock ally that can read the room, and a lawyer's not going to do that for you. You need someone who knows the business, don't you, who can kind of lay your options out for you, and as you say, Mark, tell you when, you know, you need to hear something that's uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's when lawyers, guns and money are deployed that, you know, it's all going down, don't you, in the words of the song. I think that sort of leads us neatly, certainly in the money aspect, to your column this month, Mark, because looking at the new Aston Martin boss, Tobias Moers, Lawrence Stroll's latest recruit. So obviously Racing Point, Aston Martin share an owner or share the leader of a ownership consortium, and he's got big plans for them. You've sort of dug into that, and it seems like there's quite a few new faces in and around F1 at the moment, because your next column, which, you know, dare we preempt next month's podcast, is going to be about the new owners of Williams, who are also people who, on the face of it, haven't dipped their toes into motor racing before. So I suppose what does all this tell us about the state of the automobile industry and F1, given that we're supposed to be in the thick of a global recession because of the coronavirus?
I think maybe the fact that we're in the thick of a global recession is very much a trigger point for change. And we're seeing a lot of changes in the automotive sector. And I think the Tobias Moers appointment at Aston Martin Car Company, I hasten to add, Aston Martin Car Company as opposed to Formula One team, is kind of indicative of that. Because, as I say in the column, Daimler-Benz have had a shareholding in Aston Martin for 7 years, and rather more importantly, they provide the engines for the current range, the latest models that have been coming out of Aston Martin. Not just engines, but also infotainment. Dreadful word, but infotainment. So there's a close relationship there between Daimler-Benz and Aston Martin. And as we move towards, dare I say it, the end of the internal combustion engine as the form of power for automobiles, I think Aston Martin, as with any other car manufacturer around the world, will be looking for joint venture partners. So the Daimler-Aston Martin relationship is going to be a really important one. As we record this podcast, McLaren Automotive, Mike Fluitt, the chief executive there, has just announced the phasing out of internal combustion engines from the entire McLaren range by 2035. So that's only 15 years away. So everyone's preparing for a future beyond the internal combustion engine. And, you know, for those of us who have been petrol heads all our lives, the reality is that form of fuel and energy is going to disappear in hopefully our lifetime. I mean that in terms of, I hope I'm still around to see it for long enough. But Tobias Moers' appointment is very interesting. He's come from the AMG division of Mercedes-Benz, performance vehicle division. The current chief executive, the current big boss of Mercedes, Ola Källenius, he used to run AMG. So Tobias Moers followed him into running the AMG business. And Mr. Källenius is now chairman of the board of Daimler. So what I try to paint a picture of in the column is that really heavy hitters in Daimler-Benz have a vested interest in Aston Martin, and Aston Martin have a vested interest in that relationship. And what it means for Formula One is that we're seeing Racing Point emerge as the Aston Martin Formula One team next year, becoming really a key power player within Formula One. And when you consider then that Toto Wolff has purchased a minority shareholding in Aston Martin, you join all of these dots together and you really see Aston Martin and Mercedes-Benz emerging as not sister teams, but certainly very closely aligned Formula One teams. And that means that for Ferrari and for Red Bull Racing, the challenge...
I mean, Mark, I think we can say they are sister teams, can't we?
Given
what's happening with the Racing Point case. And the fact that they actually had data of how to build certain parts of the car from Mercedes, they must be a sister team. Like, that is as close, if not closer, than any other relationship on the grid. So,
but it means that the power play in Formula One is really changing because... I kind of... The more I see of what's happening, the more I feel Ferrari have been toppled as the most important player in Formula One politically. I think Mercedes-Benz and Toto Wolff are arguably in a much stronger position now. And in drawing Aston Martin close to them, which suits Lawrence Stroll very well, because again, as I say in the column, you know, if you have a future of Formula One where Mercedes are knocking in the championship title wins and Aston Martin are finishing second, I can promise you Lawrence Stroll is going to be very happy to play bridesmaid to Daimler-Benz and to Mercedes.
Very helpful for Mercedes to have that kind of arrangement. I feel like that's the sort of thing Toto's needed politically for a while, because you look at Ferrari with their two partner teams in Alfa and Haas, and Red Bull obviously have AlphaTauri. It felt like Mercedes was slightly outgunned sometimes in terms of, you know, being one of the big players and not really having, you know, other teams that have their back. I mean, Williams, of course, was slightly aligned based on the fact they've shared engines for a long time, but this is a much stronger partnership, isn't it? And as you say, it really strengthens their position against the other two big teams.
Yeah, and I mean, you raise a really important point there. If you want a kind of an indicator of what could have been with Williams, I think Williams could have been Mercedes' other team. And the fact
they were
that
too
Toto
proud
was,
at that point, though, weren't they? I think
the fact that Toto heritage. Came, the fact that Toto came from having invested in Williams, and that Lawrence Stroll came from having invested in Williams,
yes,
and somehow those opportunities got missed, and then it became almost not. I'm not going to say it's a fire sale, but it became almost a fire sale of Williams this year. I think coming only a few months after they sold the majority of the advanced engineering business. I'll be talking about it. I'm basically now telling you what's in my column for
preview.
Next month. Well, it's good to give a preview because actually I was supposed to file a copy with Ben Anderson last night and I haven't sent it in yet.
Yeah, I was
going
to get to that.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I did mean to email it to you this morning, but there we go. The reality is that, you know, there is a big shift going on in Formula One, and this Aston Martin Mercedes relationship is such a pivotal one. And then to your wider point, Stuart, about things like the Darlington Capital acquisition of Williams, I think there is a lot of change going on in the world. We're also seeing a change in Formula One in recent years, which is a changing of the generations. You know, you think about Ron Dennis moving on from McLaren. You think about, you know, kind of Force India moving on into... I mean, in many respects, I kind of feel that the Lawrence Stroll acquisition of Racing Point it's basically taken Jordan Grand Prix 15 years to find a proper buyer for the team. And
yes.
It's gone through, you know, Midland and Spyker and Force India and, you know, all that kind of machinations the team has had to go through. It's finally fallen into the hands of an entrepreneur who has the wherewithal to really take that team to the next level. So I think it's a changing of the guard, and I think we're going to continue to see some really interesting changes in the sport now that we have a budget cap and now that we have a Concord agreement that has been signed by all the teams, because it means that, for example, if Gene Haas wants to bring in a partner to the Haas Formula One team, now is absolutely the right time. He has established that team as a credible force, an American team. He's, you know, got a more equitable share of the revenue through the Concord agreement. He's now a player properly at the table, and it's going to be interesting time. So I don't think this Darlington Capital takeover at Williams is going to be the last of the deals that we see emerge now that Formula One has some stability between now and 2025.
Yeah. Be interesting to see, you know, what, if any, approach they take to having a hands-on involvement in the team, won't it? You know, will they start having people with eyes and ears on the factory floor? Will they be content to let the current leadership run it? Will they start looking for the dreaded CEO from outside? It's a shame, isn't it, that one of Formula One's last great, proudly independent teams has its future being secured, but maybe not in the form it enjoys at present. I'm just kind of, my mind just keeps drifting back to the final days of Caterham and the bloke from the receivers sitting there like an FKW on the pit wall, acting as if he was in charge.
But I think this is this Darlington Williams deal is a very high caliber deal. I mean, first of all, unlike Caterham, we're not talking about a team that went into administration. We're not talking about some catastrophic need for the team to be saved from destruction. It was put up for sale publicly. 12 weeks later, to the day, they announced the successful sale of the team for a substantial amount of money. Now, not as much money. I was actually looking back at previous estimates of what people thought Williams was worth, and it had to make me laugh. Only 2 or 3 years ago, there was an article, I think on Forbes, saying Williams was worth $600 million. Well, the team was sold for £137 million, and of that £137 million, £36 million of it went to pay off debt So actually, what you've now got is a debt-free team. You have a team where the previous shareholders have all been paid pretty handsomely for their efforts in keeping Williams going. And I think it's great. It's a great indicator. You know, when you get these press releases announcing a takeover, they're going to keep the information to the bare minimum. But it was very encouraging that the bare minimum included the fact that the Williams team name, the nomenclature of the car, and the geographic location in Oxfordshire would remain unchanged. So that, you know, they can see that the heritage and the name and the history and the achievements of that team have a huge value to it. But I'm in agreement with you, Stuart. There will be changes at the top. I think Michael Driscoll, the chief executive, who's, you know, former Jaguar Land Rover executive, I mean, he's done a very good job of keeping that team profitable until this year, you know, or, well, until last year's financial figures. He's done a very good job kind of managing the business. But you'd have to say, of course, there are bound to be changes. And hopefully they'll bring in the right calibre of people from within Formula One and also from outside the sport, because it is sometimes helpful to bring in people who have a fresh approach to the business.
I think it is important for the sentimental side that the Williams name remains, and that seems like the biggest fear that Williams itself had about going down this route in the past. You know, it's well known that they could have got into bed with BMW in the previous manufacturer era, and you know, Frank decided not to do that because he didn't want to give up control of the team. In this case, I guess they've eventually just had their hands forced by the fact that you can't sustain the level of competitive decline for so long that they've had without serious financial ramifications, or without, you know, trying to get people on board who can plug the gap. And they, you know, they had Stroll for a time and that didn't really work out. I mean, I guess he wanted more control of the team than they were prepared to give up. And now they're at the situation where essentially they're desperate for money. And if you have to choose between the future of the team, survival, or just going under, then you have to go down this route. And we just have to hope that they found in this process the right buyer with the right sensibilities and the right sensitivity to what Williams are about, that they don't completely wreck that heritage, I guess. But, you know, if they're pragmatic about it, what they'll want to do is make sure that Williams finally starts climbing back up the grid in the way that they've been trying to for so many years now, promising and not quite delivering.
I suppose it's important to point out that a change of owner and some new ideas doesn't necessarily mean breaking every single thing that makes an entity what it is. But sometimes there are ingrained bad habits that perhaps an organisation hasn't interrogated sufficiently, and it takes an outsider to point that out to them and bring change. I'm sort of thinking about Adrian Newey's sort of well-worn anecdote of when he moved his drawing board into Red Bull Racing, and he came up against a lot of resistance, people saying this isn't how we do things in Jaguar, etc. And you know, after a while his response was, you know, it's how we do it now, or you can play spin the P45, chum. That's probably not his exact words, but so sometimes, you know, the people do say this isn't how we do things around here, and maybe that does need to be how things are done.
And that's something that, you know, that's a path that Williams have been on recently, you know, that Claire Williams has identified many times to us in the pages of our magazine, that the culture at Williams isn't quite right, that they need to modernise, that they need to move on from some of the traps of the past. They have been doing it in some areas. They've struggled to get the whole thing together. Obviously, the Paddy Lowe experiment didn't work out. That set them back a year or two further than they probably were planning on when they started this process of recent renewal. But as you say, Colin, it can be quite difficult, even if you've identified that you have a problem that you need to enact serious change to fix it. Maybe you don't have the right mix of personalities. There's too much skin in the game, too much history and baggage there to actually make the changes internally. You need sometimes some outside parties to come in and just bang some heads together and force through the change that you haven't quite been able to make yourself. Only people within Williams will know, obviously, but let's hope that this is a good move. Obviously, it secures at least the short-term financial future of the team, and that can only be a good thing because, you know, with the Concord agreement signed and the budget cap in place, there's a better chance now to have 10 sustainable, healthy teams rather than several who are just scrabbling from year to year to survive.
There's another matter of moment this week, which is the 70th anniversary of the first publication of Autosport. Fair to say, Autosport has played a big role in the careers of all three of us on this podcast. So we're very pleased our colleagues on the other side of the virtual office, who we haven't seen for ages, are keeping the good ship Autosport on course, because it's been a valuable part of our lives, and fantastic to see it last so long and deal with a lot of the challenges that have been thrown at it this year with the coronavirus, shops being shut and all that. Autosport's out every week. We are out every month. You can buy GP Racing on the newsstands now. It's got Fernando Alonso on the cover. I've been Stuart Codling. Thank you very much, Ben Anderson.
Thank you. I'm glad I stayed awake for the whole thing.
You could have a little dad nap now, can't you? Thank you, Mark Gallagher.
Thank you very much. I'm off to have my 11s now.
Oh, fabulous. I think it's time for coffee. Time for me to build my column on Autosport and add some extra filth and perhaps wait for the Cornish fish delivery that FedEx is soon to bring.
Mustn't it, Codders? Because we were expecting that to interrupt the podcast.
We were expecting a knock on the door, but no, FedEx has failed to deliver pre-morning. It's a good thing I wasn't expecting it for lunch. Otherwise, I'd have to go and hack off a limb or something. But anyway, we'll be back next month. This has been a Motorsport Network production. All the terrible bits have been edited out by Martin Lee. We'll see you in a month's time. Thank you.